Welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. We're going to spend the next hour discussing this week's most important issues with our newest Seattle City Council member, Lorena Gonzalez. Congratulations on your swearing in last night.
Well, thank you, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Seattle journalist Erica C. Barnett. The C is for crank.com. Hi, Erica.
Hi, Bill.
University of Washington philosophy professor Michael Blake. Hi, Professor.
Hi.
Thanks for coming in today.
Thank you.
On the day before Thanksgiving, let's begin with the latest news. Classes were canceled yesterday at Western Washington University in Bellingham after violent threats against students of color. This morning, some students held a news conference to call on the president of Western to do more to make sure students feel safe. They want extra security and a general campus-wide alert. I asked Junga Subedar with the Whatcom Civil Rights Project why the students want extra security.
There has been threats online on Yik Yak and a few other online forums where there were threats to students of color and to specifically black students, threatening bodily harm, lynching on a tree, and rape.
What prompted those threats, as far as you know?
As far as I know, there was a discussion about changing the mascot, which is a Viking at Western. And there was a misstatement saying that the students wanted the mascot changed. And then there were a flurry of comments in regards to that misstatement that students supported already a change in that, and specifically targeted to students of color.
So you're saying the people making the threats have invented or at least exaggerated the complaints that some students have about the Viking mascot?
Yeah, and it was based initially, it seems, on a misstatement by some media that students of color support a change. And that was never, that they never stated that.
A group of Western students held a news conference today. We invited that group, at least one of those students, onto the air. They referred us to you, Junga. Why is that? Why aren't the students speaking out themselves?
Because they feel threatened for their safety and their lives. They were not going to come to this press conference for that same reason, but came for a short while and had to leave because there's no safety measures here. There's no law enforcement here. All we could do as a community was support them. And they took a big risk in coming to the press conference as they did today. And they didn't want to expose themselves any longer to any threats or to their safety. So they did a very brief press conference and then headed back to somewhere where they could try to feel safe.
Students trying to feel safe. That was Junga Subedar with the Whatcom Civil Rights Project and the Racial Justice Project. Now, these students are responding to what they say are specific bodily threats, lynching, rape. Some students have also used the language of safe spaces, even without such direct physical bodily threats. We have heard this call from students at Missouri, Yale, Princeton, the University of Washington. UW microbiology student Pauka Shabale rallied 2 weeks ago for a more multicultural curriculum, more professors of color, and also for more safe spaces for minority students. She told me why some Husky students of color don't feel safe.
I feel as though black culture and the culture of African Americans in this country and even in Washington State doesn't really matter. We are kind of pushed away, and that's very disheartening. It already makes the campus a very daunting place because you're walking in to a predominantly white institution and you're already starting to face hostility when you're walking into the campus.
Do you feel physically unsafe, emotionally unsafe?
Emotionally unsafe, physically unsafe because of institutional racism, and I would say because of systemic oppression. And these educational systems and the way that they're set up don't really provide an environment of safety. Like, a lot of people don't really know about the effects of white supremacy and white privilege.
Is safety the best way to frame issues of racial injustice today? Maybe not, says a former student activist. Todd Gitlin was with the important activist group Students for a Democratic Society in the 1960s. Today he's a writer and a professor at Columbia University. Welcome, Todd.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
What is the problem in your eyes with today's students framing their complaints as being about safety, even when there's in the absence of bodily threats?
Well, because it blurs some important distinctions. In my mind, the question of racial justice is preeminent, and issues of injustice should be couched as issues of injustice, phenomena like abusive physical treatment and threats and underrepresentation in all kinds of places in the society and so on. Those should be addressed straightforwardly as political grievances, acting from the premise that the students are right, that they have the arguments, they have justice on their side, and that if anybody is threatening them for making these demands, then they are indulging either in hate speech, which is a crime, or in some other kind of unseemly conduct, which should be addressed head on. But when some students are hiding from photographers, for example, as happened in Missouri famously a couple of weeks ago, viewing argumentation as the equivalent of abuse, then I think they have now crossed the line and are objecting to the essential, in a way, constitutional principle of the university, that it's a place for argument. So the arguments need to be sustained. The university need to be safe for contest. It should not be safe for those who threaten bodily harm. When we get to the area of emotional harm, I think one should bend over backward to accord proper respect to freedom of speech. I'm not talking about the freedom to insult. I'm talking about the freedom to make arguments.
Todd Gitlin, who was with the Students for a Democratic Society in the 1960s, what contrasts do you draw between the student activists of today and activists of American past?
Well, we have to be, you know, we can't compress the entire history of the 1960s into one sentence. It went through many shifts and turns. But one has to be impressed if one studies the history of the civil rights movement early in the 1960s, that at a time when students and others were facing actual murder from white supremacists, they conducted themselves with a tremendous dignity. They were confident that they would win. And yes, they did demand protection when physical protection was required. In fact, that was a major demand of the early civil rights movement, that the Kennedy administration send troops if need be, and FBI men for sure, to protect them against the Ku Klux Klan, the White Citizens Councils, and other murderous ventures. But there's, I think that what strikes me as unhappy in the current situation is that there's a sort of a going-in assumption that the people who are suppressed are also weak. And that power is automatically something fearsome. I don't think power should be seen as something fearsome. I think power should be asserted as a matter of justice when the claims that are made in its name are just. And there is something, I think, of a feeling that administrators need to be empowered to do the protection. And so you get a growing middle sector. You get administrations growing much faster than either student bodies or faculties, sometimes trying to impose what are essentially legalistic solutions to social problems.
Todd Gitlin, formerly with Students for a Democratic Society, now a professor at Columbia. Keep listening. I want to bounce this off some of our guests here. A brand new Seattle City Council member, Lorena Gonzalez, former WSU Cougar. What do you make of Todd's argument, which to encapsulate it includes the idea that modern students are approaching this as if they are weak, instead of we need to be safe, but we are strong, we will be strong, we can do this.
Well, I'm not sure that I buy into that characterization of what's happening here. I think it does take a lot of courage to come out to, we heard at the top of this piece, it takes a lot of courage for students to show up in spite of understanding that they may be subjected to some bodily harm. So I think that the safety concerns are real. I think that their reaction to those safety concerns are real. And I think that it takes a lot of courage to, in spite of those real safety concerns, to show up. And I don't think that that is weak.
Separate from the, as we heard, the bodily threats of lynching and rape, we also heard a student say that just the racial oppression, the color, the faces that don't look like mine, it all adds up. Here we've seen yet another video of a police shooting white officer. Yeah. You know, we go on and on, right? That separate even from these threats, it's an unsafe, this at a very mostly white institutions, college, in some cases colleges. Mm-hmm. They feel to the students their direct experiences that mm-hmm. I feel unsafe just being looking like I do.
Yeah, I mean as you mentioned, I went to Washington State University. I went there in 1998. I went to community college first, that was literally two blocks away from my hometown of Grandview, where a majority of the people were Latino and looked like me. And when I made the transition from community college to Washington State University in Pullman, Washington, that was a culture shock for me. And for a lot of reasons, from everything from the food to the way people interacted to walking in this place that they called Greek Row. And to me, when I went to Washington State University, it was very scary. I was there for 2 months and wanted to quit and go home.
You felt unsafe?
I felt unsafe. And for me, Greek Row symbolized a lack of safety. And sometimes as a person of color, which I am, you understand that you are walking in an environment that is not made or designed for you.
Todd Gitlin, what do you say to that?
I think that it goes without saying that people who are different or and stigmatized in a given society, when they're in an environment where most people don't look or sound like them, will feel a whole range of emotions, some of which may be fearful. I get that. The question is, how powerful does that feeling of fear have to be? There's a difference in my mind between feeling unsafe because you're at a Black Lives Matter demonstration in Minneapolis and you've got some white supremacists roaming around in masks and guns and the police are not protecting you. That is obviously it's horrible and cannot be permitted. But simply to be a person who's a minority of some form or other on a campus dominated by people of other characteristics, there are things we all have to live with. The world cannot be made squeaky safe. To be safe from physical harm is one thing. And if, as was reported at the top of the hour, if the students in Bellingham felt unsafe and have reason to feel unsafe because there are threats, and they arrive at a press conference and they have a reason to expect, they have a right to expect that they'll be physically protected, and they're not being protected, I think they're within their rights. I mean, of course, they've been abandoned.
Todd,
but if it's simply a matter of feeling that, you know, you don't like everything that comes out of everybody's mouth or you don't like everybody's expression, we cannot control for emotional disturbance. We can't do that in a society without turning it into a padded cell.
I just want to jump in on a couple of points. You know, I think there is a difference. I agree that there's a difference between physical threats and emotional threats. But I don't think that, you know, that one is worth protecting against and the other is not. you know, perhaps in the 60s, in the time when Mr. Gitlin was involved in the civil rights movement, that was the case. I think today we have a different environment where we can ask for more. And, you know, for, you know, the gay rights movement, for example, fighting against casual homophobia in society, that used to be everywhere. And I do believe, and I am not a member of that movement, but I do believe people felt threatened, and not just physically. And I think that, you know, it's easy for a white person to say, you know, we have to, there are things we all have to live with everywhere. Actually, we don't all have to live with them. People who are minorities coming into a campus that's primarily white do have to live with them, and they leave in droves because of that feeling that they are not safe.
I'm going to give the final word to our guest, Todd Gitlin, because Todd, you specifically did, you wrote in the New York Times about the gay rights movement and how even that was different from what you're seeing today from these discussions of race on campus.
Well, the demand to be free of curses of gay people, let alone gay bashing, was completely right. That's a civil rights issue. Everyone who believes in equality should have, and almost all did, I believe, support protection from abuse. But you cannot legislate that people will look at you with, you know, kindly. There may be many reasons why people don't like your looks or don't like your manners or so on. And in a society of tough-minded, equal citizenship, there's no way to protect. There's no way to force everybody to make nice to you. And I think that demand is actually weakening. That's what I was objecting to in the piece. The assumption that one is at peak vulnerability.
Todd Gitlin has a history in the civil rights movement with the group Students for a Democratic Society in the 60s. He joined us as a professor at Columbia University today. Todd, thank you.
You're very welcome.
And now to a University of Washington professor himself, a professor of philosophy, Michael Blake.
Just one thing I want to challenge in what Todd Gitlin has said is that I don't think we're talking about forcing people to love one another. What we're forcing them to do is to not engage in certain patterns of behavior that systematically exclude others. And I think we already do that. It's called sexual harassment law. We've articulated a vision that the workplace cannot be as hostile as it has traditionally been, precisely because there are certain kinds of interactions that are alienating. I share Todd Gitlin's worry that the language of safety might be overly capacious. But I disagree that to insist upon the absence of certain kinds of alienating practices is to engage in thought police. I think we have more fine-grained tools, and we've shown how to make them work.
We've been talking about the modern expression of students' desire for equity, for justice, and for safety on campuses. And it sounds like this conversation, I'm hearing it more, not less, these days, and it's been going on at the University of Washington, Western Washington most recently. We'll keep following it on KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information, and we're going to keep talking about some of the stories this week. Paid family leave voted down in Seattle, at least for now, extended paid family leave. We'll talk about why Canada is settling Syrian refugees much faster than we are, and more. Stay tuned. You just heard some pretty polite disagreement here on KOW. It got a little more direct when we turned the microphones off. But let's talk about disagreement here. Holidays are the time for strange bedfellows. You know, Thanksgiving feasts bring together in-laws, extended family, and friends who agree to eat together but don't necessarily agree on much else. KOW's Amy Radel spoke with people who bridge the political divide. Here's how they make it work.
I think you need ground rules. And one of the ground rules that we've always had in our family is that you can hate the policy, you can debate and yell about the policy, but you can't hate the person who's proposing it.
That's Kristen Rao Finkbeiner on Dinner Table Etiquette. She's CEO of the group Moms Rising and a self-described progressive. Her husband is a Republican. She met Bill Finkbeiner 20 years ago when he was a state legislator. She'd come to talk to him about environmental issues.
We were farther apart politically when we first met than we are right now.
These days, they live in Kirkland with their teenage children and two boisterous Portuguese water dogs. They agree on things like paid family leave. They disagree on how high taxes should be, but Bill Finkbeiner says they don't have intense debates on these issues, just conversations.
A lot of our political discourse so often is about, like, well, the goal is to sort of make this person see the error of their ways, and that's tough, you know, and you sure couldn't do that in a marriage long term.
Their message of give and take has rubbed off on their kids, who put up signs for Obama and McCain in 2008. But he says across the lake in Seattle, people seem to take political disagreements more personally.
It's just sort of identity politics a little bit. It's like, this is a little bit of who I am, I feel like, in Seattle. And everywhere these days, because people are sort of separating into tribes.
The Pew Research Center finds that fervent liberals and conservatives are likely to read different news sources and to rarely encounter dissenting views. Kristen Rau Finkbeiner says the holidays provide a rare opportunity for those tribes to connect.
So I actually think it's more important than ever before in order to maintain our democracy to actually have conversations across the table and to talk about policies without being without responding in a way that shoots the messenger, which, you know, unfortunately, at the Thanksgiving table is your relative.
You don't want anyone to feel beaten down or silenced.
That's Republican Rob McKenna, the state's former attorney general and candidate for governor. The diversity at his dinner table comes from his kids.
Democrats are delighted to find out that both my daughters are Democrats, and secretly hope that my daughters will convert me.
His daughter Madeline was also in the public eye as student body president at the University of Washington. Rob McKenna says family matters usually take center stage, but politics do come up.
You know, we're not the Kennedys, you know, with people coming to the table having assignments like, you know, reading the following New York Times article. But, you know, we've had some conversations. And, you know, Madeline and I disagreed over the raising the minimum wage in Seattle to $15.
Madeline supported it. Rob says he feared raising wages would make it harder for young people to get their first jobs. But he says it's good when families feel safe acknowledging their differences. Valerie Manusov is a professor in communication at the University of Washington. She says debates and disagreements can serve a purpose within certain parameters.
I guess I would say that conflict can't be avoided and should not necessarily be avoided, because conflict is actually the opportunity to grow and learn.
She says, show curiosity and ask questions. Don't try to win. But Manusov says you can't gloss over the fact that people often feel surprised or hurt over political differences.
When we discover that someone that we care about, who we presume is very similar to us, is not similar to us, it can really create a lot of cognitive dissonance.
She says it's easier to form friendships across political lines if you have other things in common. Phil Bevis and Annie Brule love books and the publishing business. They met 5 years ago at a poetry festival and are now business partners.
I was the state committeeman for King County, so when Annie and I met, and she was a, you know, tree-hugging, you know, Vashon-raised, anti-coal, kayak-sailing activist, I was on the state board of the GOP.
And I had just finished climbing Mount Rainier to send a message to then-Governor Gregoire about shutting down the coal plant in Centralia.
They had enough common ground to start a publishing business together, Chatwin Books. And they share news articles and talk politics all the time. Like the Finkbeiners, Bevis says he likes discussions, not debates.
I come from a really blue family, I think is the best way to put it. But at our dinner table conversations, when I was growing up, my parents would ask questions about what we thought of the news of the day. It wasn't Dad sitting at the head of the table with the answer for everything. That really shaped my perspective.
For her part, Brule says a trip to Greece shifted her perspective on what a political debate can be. Members of her host family had deep differences over the economic problems there, but the feeling over family dinner was one of camaraderie.
I realized people are heavily disagreeing with each other. They don't see eye to eye at all. And yet, there was a complete lack of tension in the air.
She says that's the spirit she's now trying to cultivate and a worthy goal for any Thanksgiving dinner. I'm Amy Radel, KUOW News.
Let's talk a little more about Thanksgiving discord in a few minutes, okay? I may offend one or two of you. We'll find out. I hope not, but if it happens, it happens. Okay? Erica C. Barnett, Lorena Gonzalez, Michael Blake. By the way, Lorena Gonzalez, new city council member, joining us. This week, let's get back to the news here. The city of Seattle rejected the idea of increasing parental leave from 4 to 12 weeks for city workers. Instead, the city will study workplace equity, which may or may not include a recommendation for more parental leave. Councilmember Gonzalez, you told KOW yesterday that expanding parental leave is your first priority as a new council member. Why is that?
I see paid parental leave as a way to make sure that we are addressing workplace inequity for women in particular. So I think that when I think about paid parental leave, what I think about in particular, given my lens, given our low wage, minimum wage working women. I think a lot of times what we do, particularly in a city as privileged as Seattle, is we tend to frame the discussion around paid parental leave in the context of professional women working professional jobs. I tend to think about it more in the sense of somebody like my mom who worked in a minimum wage migrant farm worker job doing hops or picking cherries and literally went back out into the field and climbed a 12-foot ladder within a week after having each one of her six children. So I think there's a real equity issue here, not just based on gender, but based on race. And I am prioritizing this because I think it's important. It's going to be an important tool to making sure that our city continues to be friendly to women and children.
Erica C. Barnett, you're not against paid parental leave, but you have said that we're being unfair to non-parents here.
That's right. I'm very, very much for paid parental leave and have written in favor of it many times. And I think that, you know, the city council definitely has challenges about funding the 12 weeks, but I think it should be a priority, not just at the city level, but throughout the city. The objection that I raised, and it's not even really an objection, it's a request for expansion of the notion of paid time off, which is that people who are not parents also pursue life choices that take time, energy, and nurturing. The pushback that I have received about, you know, sort of comparing people who are non-parents and want to go join the Peace Corps or want to do service work in their communities to parents is that parenting is one, that parenting is harder than anything that one could possibly do, and two, that kids are vulnerable. The point of paid parental leave is to protect children. I think the point of leave should be, in addition to protecting children, it should be about the workers, and it should be about providing a benefit to the workers as part of their job that says you are not just a robot who works here 52 weeks a year and gets 2 weeks off, maybe, if you're a professional. I think it should be treating them like human beings and giving them the opportunity to pursue their life choices. If their life choices are having children, that's a life choice. If their life choices are joining the Peace Corps, that's another, and they're both valid.
Well, the government does expressly value children and families. We mandate free education for our kids, too.
We also give tax breaks for people who have children.
So the city, which has limited resources, would you be okay with limiting paid time off beyond vacation for non-parents who are doing something else that the city deems good for the world? Like you mentioned the Peace Corps.
No, I think that's a terrible idea. I don't think the city should be involved in it. And I do think realistically...
Well, you did bring up the Peace Corps to say, you know, we do valuable things too. Should we be picking and choosing what's valuable?
No, the city shouldn't be making value judgments. If I want to write my novel or waste my time, that should be up to me. I will say, besides, you know, all of those sort of objections or additions, I do think realistically parental leave should come first. But I think an expansion of that to include non-parents is absolutely fair and ultimately necessary.
What are the ethics here, Husky philosophy professor Michael Blake?
I see the force of what Eric is saying, but I think I disagree at a pretty fundamental level. And for me, the difference amounts to the nature of the activities we're talking about. Councilman Gonzalez is absolutely right about the differential effects on women and people of color. But it should be remembered that what's going on here is that we're building humans. And there are enormous benefits that come from having children who are actually able to see parents, in addition to the ways in which this will track economic inequality and make things worse. The simple fact is it's different if I'm raising a human as opposed to if I'm writing a novel. I don't think that I have the right to make other people fund my novel, but I do think that all the people whose nursing staff will eventually emerge from people in the generation of my kids, that they have a right to have families and kids that are given as good a start as they can get.
What about communities?
Communities are built up of people. That's the issue. And we want humans, when they're born, to grow up in a as gentle, as present, as well-designed a context as we can imagine.
I don't disagree, but I don't think that that is all on the parent. And I think the work of, for example, building communities, if I wanted to take my paid time off, which I probably would, you know, doing work in my community, I think that is just as important, because you can't say, you know, it's all on the parents. If they have the 6 months, they will raise a kid, nurture a kid, and send it out into the world in a better place. That is all true, but you need the community as well. And I think that non-parents are valuable members of communities, just as valuable as parents.
Let's just say I agree, and in fact I do, so it's not much of a leap. The problem is you're now back in a situation I think you didn't want to be in, which is having the city council determine what activities actually build community. If I'm writing a novel, I'll tell you two things. One, it's going to be bad. Two, it's not going to help anyone, except for me, and I finally produced the name.
But people could take that paid time off for their kids and not take care of their kids or raise them poorly. I mean, that's the city council isn't going to be in people's houses determining whether they're using their paid time off well or whether they're wasting it.
But we are at least saying that presence is better than absence, right? It's very rare, I think, that we would say a kid would be better wandering the streets.
Well, no, but those aren't the alternatives. I mean, the alternative may be poor parenting. It may be, you know, it may be actually parenting that is not beneficial. I mean, what I'm saying is you can't dictate or follow up on, you know, how well people are doing from a city council level with their benefits. You can't do that with vacation. People waste their vacations all the time.
You know what? If this discussion went on and on, it would not be a time waster. I would feel confident about that. But we're gonna follow other issues too. Final word in a sentence, City Council Member Lorena Gonzalez. Odds of the city actually expanding paid parental leave from 4 to 12 weeks?
I think that it's going to be possible, and I think hopefully I will be able to provide some leadership on a path forward. I do think this is important. I respect Erica's perspective. I think ultimately work-life balance is something that we're all striving towards. I think paid parental leave is a good first step, and then taking a look at overall how do we have that workplace balance with life, irrespective of what you might be doing in life, is going to be really important.
On with the news. Syrian refugees, power out. Thanksgiving conversation out or in? Stay tuned. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. While Americans argue over whether to accept any Syrian refugees, Canada's deciding how fast to do it. We welcome Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Vaughn, President Obama wants to admit 10,000 Syrians in the next year or so. The Canadian government wants 25,000 by the end of now February. What's the hurry?
Yeah, the Canadian government this week is slowing down a little bit. They're still going to take 10,000 by the end of the year. The original idea, Bill, was 25,000 by the end of the year. And I think we were even hearing from advocates for refugees saying, you know, don't be in such a rush. Make sure you screen everybody carefully. Get them all in, but don't insist on doing it by New Year's Day. And they've backed off. They're still going to take, the Canadian government, 25,000 refugees. They are going to, as well, admit another 10,000 through private agencies, through private sponsorship. But you're right. The screening is going to be more careful. The security concerns and logistics are going to be better managed. And they're not in as much of a rush as they were originally. It's funny. It was an election promise, you know, and the government just got elected in October. And I think they were reluctant to sound like they were breaking an election promise. But if you look at the reaction across the country today, I think it's mostly relief, like, take your time. We're going to take all these people, but we don't have to do it in such a rush.
The main argument from Americans who want to accept Syrian refugees, including Washington State's governor, is that we already have a slow, deliberate screening process. How are Canadians reacting to Trudeau's timetable, even the slightly expanded one now?
There certainly are people in Canada that have got reservations about this and that think that it's still too much of a rush and think that we should be processing people but not based on targets. So there still is some reluctance. But I think a lot of the really heightened concern has diminished with people saying, okay, we see what you're doing. We think you're being more careful. The Canadian method is actually we're relying on the United Nations. We're relying on refugee screening protocols that were originally developed in the United States in the wake of 9/11 and that Canada has adapted. We are sending our own officials overseas to double check all the registrations. We're focusing on low-risk people, women, children, young single men who are, the most likely to be in the terrorist group. Young single men will be admitted only if they're coming with their parents or if they fall into a high human rights abuse group, which is they are lesbian, gay, or, well, obviously young men aren't going to be lesbian, but gay, transgender, bisexual. So we're not... the government, I think, has done a lot in the last week, Bill, to address the concerns and to say, look, we want this to work, too. We don't want a backlash, and they've taken a number of steps to minimize the risk of a backlash.
Final question, then. Vaughn Palmer, Vancouver Sun. We've learned this week that Belgium has had trouble integrating Muslim immigrants. How confident are Canadians that Syrian Muslims will fit into Canada's fabric?
Had a pretty good experience integrating people going back to the 1970s when we took refugees from Uganda, taking Vietnamese in the 70s. There isn't a lot of concern. I think one of the reasons that there isn't as much concern in Canada is we haven't had the kind of attacks that have occurred in the United States. Now, some people might say we've been lucky. Some people would say, well, the attacks in the United States haven't been from refugees. They've been from people in the United States. But I think, people recognize the government has got to be careful. But at the moment, I would say there is a consensus that the government has reduced the risk and is proceeding with some deliberate caution.
Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer, always great to talk with you. Vaughn, thank you.
Bye-bye, Bill.
Bringing us up to date on the Canadian plan for admitting not 10,000 in the next year or so, but 25,000 Syrian refugees to Canada now by the end of February. It could be a cold, dark Thanksgiving on the Kitsap Peninsula. More than 13,000 people there are still without power after a strong windstorm took down trees and power lines on Tuesday. Many residents are wondering if the power is going to go back up before the big day. Bainbridge Island resident Andre Tendam is one of them. Hi, Andre.
Hi.
You have no power. What happened?
When I drove home yesterday from work, it's about 5 o'clock, I think, there was like a power line right down where our road is, where I can access our house. There was like a power line was down and tree had fallen over it. So I couldn't even like drive on the driveway to our home and had to walk into the woods on a little trail to get to our house.
Unlike your native Netherlands, Bainbridge Island does get power outages, a lot of trees and above ground wires. So you've been through this before because you lived on Bainbridge for a while. So what's the strategy for Thanksgiving?
The strategy is, we're going to go to my wife's aunt's house. She is living also on the island and fortunate enough, checked in with her not too long ago. She actually got power back early this morning. So we're going to get dinner, eat dinner there at her place.
No barbecued turkey necessary.
No barbecue turkey,
okay.
But I was actually planning on it, to have a backup plan to barbecue turkey at a friend's house.
Okay, then my final question, because you know the there's a background stress around Thanksgiving, right? What if something goes wrong? What if something doesn't turn out? So you already have the mess baked in to Thanksgiving. So what's it like for you? How are you and your family experiencing this?
We're trying to like make it work, and hopefully the power comes back on before Thanksgiving. We had like a meal, my wife and I. We're gonna add something to the meal for our. It was the plan for our at our aunt's house, and like cranberry sauce and some pumpkin pie.
Mm-hmm. How stressful versus exciting then?
Huh?
How stressful versus exciting overall?
It helps when it happened more already the past years, so we kind of get like a little bit used to it, and you kind of start to deal with having a backup plan.
Right.
So it's not as stressful anymore.
Good advice, especially on Bainbridge Island. Andre Ten Dom, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
More than 13,000 people without power on the Kitsap Peninsula. Coming up, let's say you don't have that excuse for why Thanksgiving is stressful. It's just you. And your family. Remember, the crazy one's always the uncle, it's never you, right? Stay tuned. We're with Husky philosophy professor Michael Blake and Seattle journalist Erica C. Barnett and city council member Lorena Gonzalez. And we're talking Thanksgiving, a time for food, family, football, and fighting for some of us. You haven't seen these people in months. You're going to call them on their bull. But how can we air our differences and still remain a family unit? For this family on Saturday Night Live, the answer is music, the music of Adele. When the fighting gets to be too much, a wise little girl starts the CD player and the family can't help singing in unison.
Oh, the pies are ready. And I am ready to vote for Ben Carson. You are such a...
Hello.
It works. So how does your family handle controversial topics on Thanksgiving? Here's a little advice from Dan Pashman, host of the Sporkful podcast.
There's a bell curve when it comes to alcohol. You know, Aunt Gertrude's a little crazy, but I love her anyway, because you got a beer in you and it's all going to be okay. But when you have six beers in you, that's when you're liable to fight. So I would say moderate alcohol consumption at Thanksgiving is a good thing.
Now, for more advice on what to do, I called Lizzie Post, co-host of the podcast Awesome Etiquette. Are you able to play that, Bernard?
I say focus on the food and focus on light conversation. Those two things are never going to get you into trouble. Simple stuff like movies, books, trips that you've taken, not politics, not religion. Keep it simple, keep it light, and always, I think this is the perfect holiday to just bring the focus back to the food.
Even if that's a little cowardly and complacent?
Totally, if it's cowardly and complacent.
No minds will be changed here. Stuffing will be it. So here's the thing, Lizzie. Seattle has a lot of liberals. And so this is a realistic scenario. There's a dinner table, Thanksgiving dinner table, full of progressives. And in walks Uncle John from Kettle Falls with his Donald Trump hat. Okay, what is your advice for Uncle John, who really wants to talk politics in this room full of Democrats and socialists?
The likelihood that he's going to convince any of these people of his agenda, of his viewpoints in politics, that they are right and valid is really slim. A lot of times when we talk politics, we want to feel like someone agrees with us. And when you're talking with someone who holds totally opposing views, there's little that you're going to agree on from the get-go. So going into it, if you go into it with the idea of, I'm going to explore their thought and learn about their thought process, I'm not going to try to convince them that they're right or wrong, but I just want to learn what they have to say, that would be a safe way to move ahead with that conversation. But as soon as you start challenging, as soon as you start, there are ways to have that conversation well, but my guess is that it's not going to go very well.
Lizzie, what is your worst, or let's say most memorable experience talking, getting into something on Thanksgiving?
I think one of the hardest ones is I have a relative I don't really share a sense of humor with. We don't have the same idea of what's funny. And I've just learned to walk out of the room when that relative starts telling certain types of jokes. I'm just like, you know, that's just not for me. And so I'd rather walk away than, you know, and I've told this relative before. I'm trying so hard to not even use pronouns. I've told this relative before, you know, those aren't jokes that I find funny or really, really want to entertain. So I've done all the things that I would tell me to do, and now that's just kind of how I manage that situation.
Lizzie Post is co-host of the podcast Awesome Etiquette. I'm grateful for your presence here. Happy Thanksgiving.
Well, thank you so much. I'm very grateful to have been able to be here, and I hope you all have a lovely Thanksgiving as well.
So there's somebody who's an expert on etiquette, and she doesn't engage at Thanksgiving. You think she'd be best at it. Doesn't anyone here throw themselves into a good argument, Erica C. Barnett?
I do not, and I'll tell you why.
You argue all the time.
Exactly. Well, let me
she
tell
needs
you,
a break.
Let me tell you a little about my family. So I am not from Seattle. I am from the South. My family lives in Texas and Mississippi, and they are all, I would say my mom is moderate, and the rest of my family is from fairly conservative to Tea Party.
Mm.
So my strategy is to change the subject. If someone says something that is actually offensive, like racist, I will not say that is not for me. I will say that is racist. I'm leaving the room.
Oh.
But here's the deal. My dad is like me. We are the exact same person. It's just that he's a Tea Party conservative and I'm a flaming liberal. And so when we start talking, my mom, who is the conciliator, will jump in and, you know, she'll say, Paul, Erica, you two are exactly alike. Now you stop it right now. We're going to change the subject. And she and her, frankly, her attempts to get us to stop talking are so irritating that I think to both of us that it has the intended effect and we stop talking.
You're back together again on
that
point.
And we're back together again.
University of Washington Professor Michael Blake, surely a philosophy professor, appreciates aggressive inquiry.
We do, but in general, we think it's rude to force it on the unwilling. So that's where I'm going to pick up on something Erica said, which is sometimes it can be fun if you're with someone who enjoys a good argument. But if it's just going to be something akin to abuse, why do you feel the need to simply rehash intractable differences over a dinner table?
You can always do it better this time.
Well, you can, but here's the worry. You have to figure out what you want out of an argument. Sometimes it's just the sheer thrill of arguing. But if you actually think you're going to make something better in the world, you have to figure out what it is. And if it's your drunk uncle who loves Trump, will he actually be swayed by facts and arguments, or is this just throwing words into the void? If it is, you don't really have, on my view at least, any obligation to engage, unless perhaps there's someone watching that you think could be led away from the trap of whatever you regard as political stupidity. Or perhaps if something is so egregious, as perhaps the racist comments we've been mentioning are, that you think you wouldn't maintain your self-respect if you didn't at least notice and call on them.
Lorena Gonzalez, what if someone in the room at Thanksgiving is actually a sitting politician? Okay, like brand new member of the Seattle City Council. You got to talk about it. But you're talking politics immediately.
Yeah, you know, and this is my first Thanksgiving as a sitting politician, so
right.
I'll let you know how it goes. But I think, just by way of background, I have three brothers, two sisters, 12 nieces and nephews, and 5 either sister-in-laws or brother-in-laws in total. So my immediate family is huge, and we have not perfected the art of subtlety in anything.
Uh-huh.
So I think, you know, we have really open conversations. We're all very liberal, and that makes it really interesting. But I think really what we understand fundamentally, because we've always been a tight-knit family, is the concept of respect. And we understand that even when we differ on our liberal views, that at the end of the day, we love each other because we're family, and are able to sort of walk away from that later on with a story about, remember that one time when you said that one thing?
Yes.
And I called you a Republican and you got offended? Oh. That was hilarious.
We've been asking you, dear listener, for your stories about talking politics. Here's what we heard.
A few years ago, I was back in the Midwest for Thanksgiving with my family, and my cousin and my grandfather started talking about Obama, and that quickly escalated into a screaming fight, which ended with my grandpa standing up and declaring that my cousin was out of the will. So that's how Michelle lost her inheritance.
Is that an ethical reason to not engage because you might get cut out of the will?
It's a good one, but I don't think it counts as ethics.
Okay, let's hear another listener story.
I had a political Thanksgiving incident when I came home from college wearing a shirt that said, Bush lied, soldiers died, the same Thanksgiving that my uncle was coming home from Afghanistan, which resulted in me being forced to sit at the children's table.
Okay, someone has a shirt that says, Bush lied, soldiers died, and your solution is to put that shirt in front of young children.
It wouldn't be my solution.
No?
I am absolutely confrontational about non-confrontation at my family dinners.
So it's not just racist comments if someone is stepping to you with an aggressive political shirt.
I would be fine with that.
Oh.
If it becomes a topic of conversation at Thanksgiving, I think that's an inappropriate venue. And I'm saying this as like the most confrontational person I know.
If people only knew how much you love to confront. Or maybe you don't love it. I don't know.
I just do it. I do love it, but not with my family. Because the thing is, I'm not going to change them, and I'm going to love them regardless of what they believe.
I went to you know who John Gottman is? The marriage expert, nationally known. And I went with my wife to one of his seminars, a big group thing at Seattle Center. And he said that successful couples have what he called an Israeli, did he say Irish? I think Israeli-Irish attitude to conflict, which is maybe being stereotypical, but it's, let's get at it. You know, think Seinfeld's parents, right? They squawk and they love. I'm not hearing that in my panel.
I'm still stuck on the Israeli Irish.
That's how you
hear of it. I believe it. I think there is something to.
Oh, and maybe Italian was in there. It might have been Israeli Italian. Go on.
Sorry, my brain is shifting paradigms here. I think it's actually quite accurate that it's possible for us to argue and tell the other person that they are utterly wrong and damnable and still worthy of our love.
Yeah.
In fact, I don't really want to be with someone who agrees with me. I don't like myself enough for that to be a worthwhile endeavor.
Right.
But I love arguing, and it can be done with a full commitment to the other person being worthy of love and respect.
Socrates did it?
Yeah, but they killed him.
Yeah. On that note. Professor Michael Blake, professor of philosophy at the University of Washington. Thanks for mixing it up with us, talking news and politics and family.
Thanks for having me.
Seattle journalist Erica C. Barnett. The C is for cornucopia. Is that
and
right?
Also crank.
Oh, yes. Also, C is for crank.com. And Seattle City Council member Lorena Gonzalez. You've been on the council for, what, 24 hours? Not even that.
Not even 24 hours.
Okay. So
20
hours. And what's the very first thing you're going to do when you're there in the room?
Oh, I was just there, got the keys yesterday.
The full council was there with you, so you've sat down as a
Oh, you mean a council, yeah, in council
yeah.
chambers?
Yeah.
We'll see what the first thing is. I have my first full council meeting on Monday morning, and I've been told that we have 7 different pieces of legislation to vote on, so I know what I'll be doing while eating turkey.
We'll be watching and arguing about you, Lorena Gonzalez, city council member, Erica Michael, and Bernard Ouellette, Jason Pagano, Andy Hirsch, the whole team. Thank you.
Thank you.
Are you going on Thanksgiving Day to those family celebrations? Passing on.